Okay, so first I'd like to thank Molly for inviting me to speak with you today. So in this rather famous photo, what you see is a living histogram of the height of students in the Connecticut State Agricultural College in 1977. So somebody had the bright idea of lining up students according to their height. Maybe you can't see it, and it's also in American units, but each column here corresponds to a height where the women are in white and men are in black. And the reason I'm showing you this is because height is one of many examples of traits that show a lot of variation in populations, where that variation is largely heritable or genetic in origin. In human populations and populations of many other species. And the genetic basis of height is also, like many of these other traits, a complex trait, a term I'll define in one slide. Only over the past decade or so have it become possible to systematically map the genetic basis of variations in complex traits like height and many others. And the work I'm going to talk about today is work that Yuval Simons, who you see over here, who's an exceptional young scientist, and I have done to connect these observations emerging from genome-wide association studies in humans with the processes that give rise to this type of heritable variation and complex traits. Now, I'll begin by giving some background, or actually quite a bit of background, just to get everyone on the same page. As Molly noted, and actually using quite a similar slide, then you could think about complex traits as the other extreme from Mendelian traits. So what do I mean by that? So in the case of Mendelian traits, we think about mutations in a single gene that have a fairly predictable phenotypic effect. So the trait we could think about could be the color of a pea seed, whether it's a yellow or green, or it could be many disease phenotypes like cystic fibrosis, Huntington, etc. Now, in the other extreme of a complex traits, then the trait value is determined by many small contributions in many, many loci across the genome and an environmental contribution. So in this case, if I would tell you what is the allele that an individual carries at a given locus, then that would probably tell you pretty little about the trait. But while these traits are genetically complex, actually a lot, or maybe most of the traits we care about are actually fall in this category. So this includes morphological traits like height and body mass index. It includes life history traits like the age of puberty, and it includes the risk of developing most common genetic diseases like diabetes, multiple sclerosis, schizophrenia, and so on and so on. So while for Mendelian traits and diseases in particular, we know quite a lot about the genetic basis, and a lot of it has been mapped, at least for the common Mendelian traits. And the reason is that they're fairly easy to map in familial studies. And as Molly talked about in the previous lecture, then we also understand quite a lot about the processes that give rise to variation in these traits in natural populations, particularly in diseases. Complex traits are much more difficult to map. So and the ability to do so systematically only emerged over the past decade. And I'll get to that. So the modern thinking about these complex quantitative traits is based on a model that traces back to Ronald Fisher and Sewell Wright in the 1920s and 30s of the 20th century. And let me describe to you a cartoon of this model where I'll use height as an example. So Imagine that these circles correspond to nucleotide positions in the diploid genome, where the white circles are positions where a mutation affects height, and the gray ones are positions where it doesn't affect height. Now, if we look at a particular site, and for simplicity, let's assume that it's biallelic, then we may have a short and a tall allele, and replacing one short allele by a tall one would, on average, say, increase height by 2 millimeters. Now, other sites may have other effect sizes. What the additive model tells us is that if you want to predict an individual's height, then what you do is you add up the allelic contributions over his or her alleles, and that would give you a prediction of their height. Now, this very simple idea, by the way, is the premise for phenotypic prediction in agriculture and in precision medicine. In fact, you'd be hard-pressed to go into a supermarket and find one organic item that is not a result of applications of this simple model. Now, of course, the environment affects the value of the trait as well, and Fisher modeled that by assuming that the environmental contribution is normally distributed. So what the additive model predicates is that if I add the contributions over an individual alleles and the environmental contribution, that would give me an individual's height. And I was told in the past that for the younger people in the audience, I should mention that Sean Connery on the top is taller than Woody Allen on the bottom in order to understand this slide. This simple additive model has been remarkably successful, both in explaining a huge number of observations and in practical applications, as I mentioned, in agriculture and in other fields. In particular, it explains one of the first general observations about quantitative complex traits that traces back to Francis Galton, and that is that their values are approximately normally distributed in the population. Now, not only does the model why is that the case? Simply because if you add up a lot of small independent contributions, then you converge to a normal distribution. But it doesn't only explain the normal distribution, it also tells you how to interpret the variance of this distribution. So under the additive model, the variance of the phenotypic distribution is a sum of the environmental variance and the genetic variance. And the genetic variance is a sum over the contributions of each individual site contributing to variation in the trait. Let me give you an example with data. So this figure is based on the 20 loci that were found to contribute the most to variation in height in European populations. So these are biallelic sites. So at each individual would carry between 0 and 40 tall alleles. This is the x-axis that you see over here, the number of alleles an individual carries. Now, just to give you a sense of how polygenic height is, and there's many more traits like that, then these 20 top loci, each of them has an effect of about 1 to 2 millimeters, and they account for about 1/3 of 1% of the heritable variance in height. Okay? Now, the y-axis on the left and the gray bars correspond to the proportion of the sample, the proportion of individuals that have a certain number of tall alleles, and as you see, it's approximately normally distributed. And the right y-axis, it shows the average height, and the blue dots, the average height of individuals carrying a certain number of tall alleles. And you see that there's approximately a linear relationship, which is what you would expect under an additive model. Now, I assume that some of you are asking yourselves, how could such a simple additive model account for the epistatic or nonlinear interactions that there must be between alleles at different loci affecting traits. To make that question more specific, we know, for example, that in knockout experiments in yeast, the effect of a knockout gene is different depending on whether other genes are present or knocked out. Now, what's important to understand about this is that the genetic variation segregating in natural population doesn't look like the kind of mutations that we have in knockout experiments. So population genetic theory tells us that even if among newly arising mutations you obviously have large effects mutations, including loss of function and others, then the variation that will segregate in the population would, in that variation, epistasis would have a fairly small effect, and it would be well approximated by an additive model. And in fact, there's ample empirical evidence that supports that conclusion. Now, another question you might ask yourself about the additive model is how could a model of a continuous trait be associated with complex disease, where we often think about complex disease as a binary state, either having the disease or not. So here's the way that the two are usually related. So we think about some underlying phenotype referred to as liability, which is an additive trait that arises from additive genetic contributions and an environmental contribution. And then we assume that if this liability exceeds a certain threshold, then the disease ensues. So there's variations on this model, but they look pretty much the same in human genetics. So the additive model explains another important general observation, and this is the linear relationship between the phenotypes of relatives. So here you see a famous plot from Francis Galton showing the average height of children, the height of children as a function of the average height of their parents, where they're with the proper normalizations for males and females. The size of these circles corresponds for the number of individuals that has corresponding parameters within the sample. This dashed line corresponds to the y equal x line, where we would expect the regression line to fall if the genetics would have fully determined the value of these traits. When you do the linear regression, you get the black line, which has a lower slope. That slope differs between different traits. Now, the additive model not only explains the statistical linear relationship between children and mid-parents, or any pair of relatives for that matter, but it also gives a very simple interpretation for what this slope is. This slope, the slope of this regression, is simply the proportion of phenotypic variance that is genetic in origin, okay? And this is how we define heritability in quantitative genetics. As the specifically, it's the slope of this regression for children and mid-parents, but you could get similar relationships for other relatives. So this heritability, the proportion of genetic variance from the total phenotypic variance, is, if you like, the answer of quantitative genetics to the contribution of nature versus nurture to the phenotype. Now the heritability of many traits has been measured for, you know, about 100 years now using the correlation between relatives and other means. So here you have some numbers for this heritability. So on the top, what you have is some numbers for humans, specifically in European populations. On the bottom, you have values for a whole bunch of species and traits. may be difficult to see exactly what you see here. The important point here is that the x-axis goes between 0 and 0.9, and the green bars on the top correspond to morphological traits, and the blue ones on the bottom to fitness or life history-related traits. Now, you see a couple of things here which are generally true. One is that heritability values, the genetic contribution, are usually substantial, somewhere between 20 and 80% across traits, across many such measurements. We don't know why that's the case. Another thing is that some pattern emerges. For example, heritability values are greater for morphological traits than they are for fitness-related and life history traits. We also don't know why that's the case. We know something about these questions, but these are largely open questions. Now, heritability estimates are also important for mapping efforts, because when you map a number of loci that contribute to variation in a trait, then you could add up the contribution of these loci to variance, and then you could compare that to the variance, to the total variance that you know to be heritable, and that tells you how much you still have to go in the way of explaining the genetic variance that there is to be explained. So I've mentioned in the beginning that only over the past decade, even less, we've been able to systematically map the genetic basis of these complex traits. And this is largely due to genome-wide association studies in humans. And the idea of a genome-wide association study is extremely simple. So what you do is you collect, you have a huge sample, you genotype all the individuals and you phenotype. So say you measure their height. And then you go at every segregating site, at every SNP, and you regress the trait value, say the height, against the genotype at that site. And that regression gives you a slope, which is related to the effect size of that SNP. And it gives you a p-value for the statistical significance of the association. And then what you need to do is you need to consider factors like false discovery rate and a whole bunch of other factors to determine which of these associations are statistically significant. And the results of these genome-wide association studies, or GWAS, are usually presented by these Manhattan plots, an example of which you see on the right, where on the x-axis you have the position of every SNP in the genome, where the colors correspond to different chromosomes. And on the y-axis, you have the minus log p-value for the association. So the more significant it is, the higher the value on this y-axis it is. And then you determine some genome-wide significance threshold. That's the red bar over there. And things that exceed this are considered statistically significant associations. Now, what's going to be important for us is what affects whether a SNP would be significant or not. So, obviously, the greater the effect size of that variant, the more likely it is to be significant. But it's not the effect size alone, it's also the minor allele frequency. Because if the minor allele is so rare that we rarely see it in our sample, it would be much harder to establish that a certain SNP is significantly associated with a trait. And more generally, the p-value in these association studies combine the effect size and the frequency through the contribution of that SNP to variance in the trait. Now, so let's look at an example, continuing with our example of height. So I'm giving you an example for height, but let me tell you that almost all of the SNPs that we know to be associated with height and many other complex traits were discovered by genome-wide association studies over the past decade, or maybe more over the past 5 to 7 years. So this is an example for height. And in this case, the study was performed using a sample size greater than 250,000 individuals that were genotyped at more than 2 million SNPs, variable sites in the genome, and their height was measured. This way, this study was able to find about 700 significantly SNPs that are significantly associated with height. However, when you add up the contribution of all these loci to variants, they add up to a bit less than 20% of what we know to be the heritable variance in height. And this problem occurs for many, many traits and has been termed the missing heritability problem. And to understand, to get a better understanding of the missing heritability problem, it's useful to present the results in terms of this graph that I've shown here, where on the x-axis we have the minor allele frequency at the variable site, and at the y-axis you have the effect size in some units. And the blue dots correspond to these genome-wide significant hits for the GWAS for height. This kind of representation in terms of effect size, joint distribution of effect size and frequency is referred to as the genetic architecture of these traits. And the black line here that you see is a threshold, corresponds to a threshold contribution to genetic variance, or to a good approximation, you will discover sites that contribute more than this to genetic variance, and you wouldn't discover sites that contribute less. So now this threshold contribution to variance obviously goes down when sample sizes go up, allowing larger studies to discover loci with smaller contributions. And just staring at this graph suggests the most straightforward explanation for missing heritability, which is that most of the heritable variance in height and in many other traits just comes from loci that have a contribution below our current threshold of discovery. Now, one thing we can do is we could now plot the thresholds for smaller study size, and we could estimate how much variance we would explain and how many associations we will find in smaller studies. And when you do that, it draws a picture like this that recurs for many, many traits, which is that until you reach a certain study size, you discover practically nothing. And then when you get to some threshold study size, you begin to explain some of the heritable variants and discover some associated loci, and the rate at which you do so increases. Now, this threshold study size and rate of increase is different for different traits. And for that reason, GWASs with similar sample sizes explain much less of the variance and discover many fewer associations for body mass index than they do for height. And when you ask yourself, What does that relate to? Ultimately, it has to do with the genetic architecture of these traits, and in particular, with the distribution of variance among loci contributing to variance in these traits. So if we wish to understand a missing heritability and why it differs among traits, then we should understand, we would like to understand how genetic architectures are generated by underlying processes. And with this background, I could tell you a little bit about what we've done. So our idea was to model the evolutionary processes and parameters, how evolutionary processes and the parameter values of these models give rise to the genetic architecture of traits. So doing that already gives you some insight into the results of GWAS, but more importantly, it allows you to go in the other direction and use the data from genome-wide association studies in order to make inferences about the underlying processes and parameters associated with these traits. Now, doing that allows you to address questions of both a basic and practical import. So you could look at the data from GWAS on individual traits and make inferences about the processes and parameters that affect it. You could look at different kinds of traits, for example, life history versus morphological traits, or early and late onset diseases, and hope by applying such inferences to learn about the origin of the differences in their genetic architecture. And from a practical standpoint, if we know the underlying evolutionary parameters, we might be able to predict how the explained variance and number of associations we'll discover will increase when sample sizes in these studies increase. But more generally, we might be able to inform the design of these mapping studies and models of phenotypic prediction. So let me tell you a little bit about how we actually go about it, starting from how we model the evolution of genetic architecture. And to that end, I'll start from a simple cartoon just to give you a sense of the players here. So ultimately, genetic variation in complex traits begins from new mutations that arise according to a trait's mutational target size, the proportion of the genome where a mutation would affect that trait. Once a mutation arises, the frequency it will reach is affected by the selection acting on it and by demographic processes. In particular, if we assume, as will be the case, that most of these mutations are selected against, then the stronger the selection on them, the lower their frequencies are expected to be. Now, the relationship between frequency and effect size depends critically on whether these mutations are selected for because of their effect on the trait we're looking at, or because of their pleiotropic effects of other traits under selection. So if we take, for example, the extreme in which the trait we're looking at has no effect on fitness, but the pleiotropic effects on other traits that are selected on are totally uncorrelated, then in this case, we might expect to see no relationship between effect size and frequency. So the distribution of variance may look something like this. In the other extreme, where the trait we're looking at, the effect on the trait we're looking at is actually the cause of selection on these mutations, then if a mutation has a larger effect on that trait, it would be more strongly selected on, and we might expect to see a relationship like this. The point of this slide, the reason I've showed you this cartoon, is to establish that direct and pleiotropic selection play a critical role in shaping a genetic architecture. So what do we know about selection on complex traits? So one thing we know from many lines of evidence is that many complex traits are under what's called stabilizing selection, namely a selection that favors an intermediate trait value where fitness goes down when you move away from that trait value. So here you see a classic example about birth weight, where there's a sweet spot for birth weight. And if the birth weight is above or below that, you'll have an increase in infant mortality. Another thing we know, again, both from arguments and ample evidence, is that genetic variation in one trait usually affects many, many other traits, or that pleiotropy is a pervasive phenomena. Among many lines of evidence, we know that because the associations in GWAS with one trait tend to be related to many other traits. Here's a sentence from a nice paper from Joe Pickerel's lab, a very nice work on these pleiotropic effects, where he says that variants that delay the age of menarche in women tend to delay the age of voice drop in men, decrease body mass index, increase adult height, and decrease risk of male pattern baldness. So Joe refers to this as the George Constanza genetic gradient. And more generally, the point is that we're discovering more and more pleiotropy as the methodology and power to detect it is increasing. The last thing we have learned largely from GWAS is that genetic variations in many complex traits arises from small additive contributions over many, many loci. So with these considerations in mind, we modeled a genetic architecture by extending a geometric model that was developed by Ronald Fisher. In this model, you describe the phenotype an individual in a multidimensional space where each dimension corresponds to a trait. So for example, the first trait may be height and the second one may be body mass index. So those individuals on the top right there are tall and bulky, and those in the left bottom corner are short and skinny. But what we're going to do is we're going to focus on the architecture of one trait, but the total number of traits is going to parameterize the degree of pleiotropy, okay, which we established to be an important parameter. Now, stabilizing selection is introduced by assuming that a certain phenotype in that space is optimal. For example, we could assume this is the phenotype at the origin. Okay, and what that means is that the fitness will decline as we move away from the origin. The specific shape of the fitness function turns out not to matter, and the environmental contribution to the phenotype could actually be absorbed into this fitness function, so we don't need to worry about that. We'll also assume that mutations that affect the phenotype arise at a certain rate, and their magnitude and direction in this n-dimensional trait space is chosen from this distribution. Turns out that the shape of this distribution doesn't matter much as well. Now, we're going to model the phenotype of an individual by adding up the effects over these alleles, adding their vector effects. So this is just an n-dimensional generalization of the additive model that I've shown you in the beginning. Now, finally, we make the standard population genetic assumption. So we assume that we have a population of a finite population of diploid individuals, that their fitness is determined, as I showed you, by their phenotype, and based on their fitness, they're chosen to be parents, and the genotype of their offspring result from mutation, recombination, and Mendelian segregation. So the standard population genetic assumptions. Now, one important aspect of this model is that it starts from the underlying processes rather than making assumptions about, you know, say how effect size will relate to frequency. It starts from the underlying assumptions and we will figure it out from there. So it's a generative model. The other nice aspect of this model is that it turns out that its solution is robust to a lot of the underlying assumptions, some of which I mentioned, the shape of the fitness function, et cetera. Now that's important because that tells us that maybe the results of the model are actually widely applicable to reality. Now, in the benefit of time, I'm going to skip directly to what this model tells, how it relates, the results of this model relate to genome-wide association studies, but during questions, I'll gladly answer any questions about how we solve it. In particular, we could recall that whether we identify a variant in GWAS or not depends on a threshold contribution to variance. So in GWAS, we discover loci that contribute above a certain threshold and not those that contribute below that threshold. So on the x-axis here, I just have this threshold contribution to variance. And on the y-axis, what I have is the proportion of heritable variants that come from loci that contribute that much to variance or more, okay? Because that's something that we could relate to readily to the results of GWAS. And what I'm showing you here is the predictions of our model if we assume that genetic variation is highly pleiotropic, and if we assume that the underlying mutations are under strong selection. So it turns out that if the degree of pleiotropy, namely the effective number of traits, is sufficiently high, and if selection is sufficiently strong, the shape of this distribution is insensitive to the specific degree of pleiotropy or to the specific strength of selection. And this assumption of high pleiotropy seems plausible. I'll get to the plausibility of the strong selection assumption in a moment. Another thing that's nice about this distribution is that it depends on only one parameter. And that parameter is the expected contribution of a strongly selected site to variance in the trait. So that's the units I actually use to measure the threshold on the x-axis, to measure variance on the x-axis. And that one parameter is tantamount to just measuring genetic variance in evolutionary natural units, if you like. Okay, so now what about weakly selected variants? So it turns out under this model that they contribute much less to the genetic variance in the trait. So now if you imagine our situation in variance where we gradually increase the sample size of GWAS, essentially moving from the right side of this graph to the left, reducing the threshold for discovery, then at the beginning, we're only going to pick up strongly the only strongly selected loci. And only when study sizes become very large, we're going to begin to pick up the more weakly selected ones. Okay, so it stands to reason that what we're seeing now is actually the strongly selected contributions. So if we have a single parameter for this distribution, and we have about 700 variants associated with height and about 80 with body mass index, then we could estimate the single parameter by fitting the shape of this curve and still have ample statistical power to test whether our model actually fits the data. So that's what we did using the GWAS data for height and body mass index. And here's what we get, where the graph I'm showing you here is exactly the kind of graph I've showed you before. So on the x-axis is the threshold contribution to variance, and then the y-axis is the proportion of heritable variance that comes from loci that contribute that much or more. The dark lines correspond to data. The lighter lines correspond to the fits of our model. And these light colored sleeves correspond to confidence intervals based on bootstrap. And now you could apply some version of the Kolmogorov-Smirnov test to test whether we could reject our model based on these data. And it turns out that we can't for neither height nor body mass index. But note that unlike the cases you're probably used to, not rejecting the model here is a good thing. It means that our model actually fits the data. Now, just by comparison, so you won't think that this is just a result of a lack of power, when we fit the model without pleiotropy, we easily reject it in this case. So, okay, so our model seems to fit the data well. Now, what can we learn from that about the traits? So here's some inferences we could make. One thing is we could add a parameter to this model, which is the number of effective traits or degree of pleiotropy. And that shows us, perhaps unsurprisingly, but still reassuring, that genetic variance in these traits is highly pleiotropic. It affects a large number of selected traits. Another thing we could do, if we account for the demographic history of European populations where these GWASs were performed, we could actually show that a current GWAS is well-powered to detect a variance within a certain range of selection effects, around a tenth of a percent. By extrapolating these curves to a threshold of zero, corresponding essentially to all the variants in this range that we're seeing and basing our inferences in, we could say that we could estimate that the proportion of genetic variance in height within that range of selection effects is a bit greater than 50%, and less than half of that for body mass index. This, by the way, is why the main reason we think why GWASs for height were much more successful than for body mass index. Another thing we could do by this kind of extrapolation is we could estimate the mutational target size for these traits. So how many base pairs, so essentially how many base pairs in the genome, if we have a mutation in them, they would affect these traits and have selection effects within the range we're able to see right now. And this way we estimate that about 5 million base pairs for height and less than half of that for a body mass index. Lastly, among the results I'll show you is what we could do is by extrapolating these curves for lower thresholds, remember that lower thresholds correspond to larger sample sizes. So what we could do is we could extrapolate to lower thresholds and this way predict how many loci we expect to find and how much variance we expect to see when we increase sample sizes in GWAS, which is, you know, coming over the corner. So here's a stab at these predictions. I should mention that these are underestimates because they're based on the range of selection effects we could see right now, and when we will increase sample sizes, we would see a wider range of selection effects. So I'll summarize here and say that what I hope is that I managed to convince you is that using generative models that start, that build up from first principles, we could relate the underlying process, population genetic processes with the findings that we're seeing in GWAS. And by doing that, we have a lot to learn about the processes that give rise to genetic variation and complex traits, and also maybe inform some practical questions such as how to design mapping studies and predictive models and so on. If you're interested in more details, then you could find the paper describing these results in PLOS Biology. I'll end by once again acknowledging Yuval Simmons, who did a lot of this work, and some other people who gave invaluable input to this work, and other lab meeting members, and mention that we're on the lookout for talented students, so if somebody here is interested or has a suggestion, then please catch me later. Thank you.